You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Little bit of Vietnam era music. We've been talking about Kaysan, and we'll talk about it more next week. Ken Rogers will actually join us on Monday, and the audio you're going to hear is audio that should be laid at the feet of his wife for suggesting that they do such a thing. And she suggested to him that, you know, we should record some of these stories. And so they did it, and they and it was, you know, his battle buddies, right, from Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines that he served with in Vietnam. So the other day I started to play a snippet of it, and I thought, you know what, I'm not trying to sell DVDs for Ken Rogers. He doesn't need me to do that. But when you think about Kaysan, there's a lot of things to learn from it, and in particular relative to post-combat related mental health, which this program's all about. So I want you to listen to some of the audio. There are two cuts, and they're not shortcuts, they're long cuts, and they describe the events, two events during the 77-day, quote-unquote, siege. And so the siege is not, it's not one event, right? It lasts a long time. And there's all kinds of stuff that goes on there. There's the daily shelling, if you will, that they endure, and the stories that come out of that. People dying, the napalm strikes that were being carried out in and amongst them on a regular basis. And so, but there's two incidents that I've found that are pretty amazing. And one of the other things that's really interesting is that there was some kind of tape recorder that was at Kaysan that Bravo Company had. And so there's actual recordings that get sent home and that guys kept for years that you'll hear that's a part of this. In particular, the company commander does recordings. Ken Pipes is a commanding officer of Bravo Company. He does recordings after some of these events, and you'll hear that here. And so I want you to sit back and Kaysan is in Northern I Corps, and it is an airfield, it is going to be laid siege to, and what according to the documentary makers of the Vietnam War, said was a diversion. And so in that 77 days, there's a couple significant events. And I alluded earlier in the program to a story in the Washington Post that was written, I want to say 2 days ago. And it was about a chaplain. It was about a chaplain that served with Bravo Company 126, probably the battalion chaplain for 126, and he talks about, you know, for us, it happened yesterday. And so, so I wanted to play this audio for you, and it is, it's the intensity of it, I would tell you, is incredible. And the Ghost Patrol goes out based on some intelligence they had, and as is the case in most incidents where they go wrong, the intelligence is wrong, but those on the ground don't know it yet. So, and I may stop this every once in a while to make a comment on it or to clarify something. So,
sir, you're out of order. Out of order. I show you out of order. You don't know what out of order is.
We don't need that guy. Okay. So, without further ado, here's the first of two different segments. The first one you're going to hear about something that the Marines of Bravo 126 call the Ghost Patrol. And then the second you're going to hear is, and so the Ghost Patrol, LDs the morning of February 25th, 1968. Of approximately 60 Marines that leave the wire, Marines and sailors that leave the wire, 27 are KIA, 22 are wounded in action. All right, and so this is the story. This is that story, and they are all forever scarred by this morning. And then the second cut you'll hear is from actions on March 30th, so a little bit more than a month later, 1968, and they go out. And they call it to get their payback. So, absolutely riveting work that Ken and his wife Betty have done. And so I just want to share this with you. If you enjoy documentaries, I would tell you by all means, buy it. It is unique. It is incredibly well done. And it is a story of their toughness in a very, very unique place. Bernard Fall, right? Hell in a very small place. Dien Bien Phu. Khe Sanh certainly did not have the same outcome, but those exact words certainly can describe the lives that these Marines lived for 2.5 months. So, without further ado.
In the... United States Marine Corps.
This is the company commander, and his original recording done after the 25th of February.
Company commander of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines. And will at this time make the following statement in regards to an event that happened on the 25th of February, morning of the 25th of February, involving elements of the 3rd Platoon Bravo Company and later 1st Platoon Bravo Company.
That's a tough one. I relived that thing quite a bit.
So, what do you remember about February 25th? The Ghost Patrol, the Patrol of the Ghost Patrol.
Remember about that
day? Can we stop a minute?
The patrol was to depart at 0800, return by 1000 on the morning of the 25th. They departed on schedule at 0800. Reported reaching checkpoint 1 and departing for checkpoint 2.
I had a Chuhoy scout with us, and we were supposed to follow a designated route and be bracketed on all sides by artillery within an instant. Well, we got about 500 meters, I guess, outside the gate, crossing the road, near the road, and Lieutenant Jock spotted a couple North Vietnamese standing over in a field.
A short while later, a transmission was received in the company CP that 2 to 3 NVA were sighted in the open. Actually, at that time, we figure 600 to 800 meters beyond where they were originally scheduled to be. When they reported sighting these three enemy, they requested permission to attempt to make a capture.
And he made a decision, we're going to take them prisoner. And I do remember the Chu Hoi telling them no, and a lot of us saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this. But he gave the order, so we went to get them. And I guess probably a few hundred yards further out, when we crossed the road and we crossed a set of trench lines, and then they opened up on us. And it was just pure chaos from there on.
Almost immediately, within a matter of minutes, they reported heavy enemy fire, and then immediately followed by a statement that they were pinned down. The patrol was under the command of Lieutenant Jacques.
Lieutenant Jacques, and when they got hit, I was on the radio, and you could hear it going on. I mean, we could hear it in the distance, but we could hear it on the radio, what was, you know, the screams and the stuff that was going on, and they needed help. And
men were getting shot. You could hear that happening. I moved from my bunker inside. I moved up on top because I wanted to not only listen, but to see if I could see them. But it was really very foggy that day, and you couldn't see hardly anything.
And probably within 5 minutes, all hell broke loose from the back portion of our patrol.
Just nothing you could do. It was just total chaos for that probably five minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it was.
The 25th was almost a massacre. I mean, it was just, you know, and I don't know. You know, you hear the stories. The 25th, we were out there with, I think, as I recall, there was 54 of us went out, and they estimated we hit 4,000 to 5,000 enemy, you know, in that ambush. So, it wasn't a battle. It was just, you know, you just tried to survive. I mean, we were outnumbered so heavy. There was no fight.
So we were on the radio listening to what happened. And when he was ambushed, Captain Pipes got on the radio, okay, Lieutenant. Of course, with code names, your time to go out. And two squads, we actually split up. One squad I went with straight out toward where they were. The other squad went to the right. And unfortunately, he got trapped in the same kind of ambush. And so of that squad, maybe of 10 men, I think, 4 were killed in that ambush.
And when I finally hit the ground, I could tell that Farrell was killed. My team leader, who was I think it was Lance Corporal, I believe his rank was, Thrasher from Oklahoma City, asked me to go up and retrieve the body or bring him back. You know, he still might be alive. And as I was dragging him back, the body was bouncing, was jumping back and forth. And I could feel bullets whizzing past my head. So in a sense, his body protected mine. I come across a radio operator who had been killed. To this day, I have no clue what his name was. And all I could hear on the radio was, "Hello, hello, anybody there? Anybody hear us?" So I keyed the mic and I says, "Hello." And somebody came back and says, "Well, who's this?" I said, "Well, this is Cal." "Cal who?" And I told him. He says, "Who else is there with you?" I called back and I says, "Nobody." He says, "What do you mean?" I says, "There ain't nobody here alive." I said, "They're all dead." And he says, "Where are you at?" And I says, "I'm laying next to a road and I'm overlooking another road that goes down over a hill." He says, "How did you get there?" I says, "This is where we ended up." "What can you see where you're laying down?" I could see little helmets in the background. Unbeknownst to me at the time, it was I was just a few meters away from the NVA trench line. I had no clue that I was even there, that close to him. Somebody else came on the radio and says, I want to shoot around. He says, I want you to let me know where it lands. Okay. And next thing, out comes around, and I went back and told him, I says, you shot too far. I says, you need to drop the range down. He says, how much? Now, I guess I said 50 yards, 75 yards, something. And he dropped it, shot another round. I says, there, you're right on him. He says, bury your head. He says, we're going to fire for effect. And that was the last I heard. Because all of a sudden, I just heard, bah, 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 boom, 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 boom. Just rounds were going off left and right.
I just watched the guy drop, and I took care of a couple of guys. And then I was crossing back over the road because another guy got hit. And next thing I know, I seen a guy pop out of a fighting hole. He hit me a couple of times in the chest. And I was laying there, and the other corpsman, Frank Calzia, seen me go down, and he come running over yelling at me, J.C., are you okay? Are you okay? And then a grenade landed between my legs. And I looked down, and I seen it. I just yelled him, grenade, and he hits it in the dirt. And I curled up into a ball that went off. And I couldn't hear it or, you know, see anything for a few minutes with all the dirt and everything. And then when I could see, I seen my foot over there. And I'm thinking to myself, this isn't good. So my foot moved, and I said, well, at least it's still attached. And by that time, Frank came over to me, and he says, you know, we got to get out of here. And I told him, get, you know, go take care of that guy. I'm okay. I'll take care of him. And I took care of myself. And then Lieutenant Josh come running by, and he looked down at me and said, Doc, he said, get out of here. He said, we're all getting killed. And he made it from about here to the wall, and I seen him go down. And I crawled over to him, and he caught it right across the legs, both his femoral arteries. And by the time I got to him, he already bled to death. There was nothing I could do for him.
And then we got the word, come back, retreat. And I remember very well because we were laying out in the open. I mean,
this is Lieutenant Weiss. He was the one. He was the lieutenant who led the two squads that acted as a QRF. So this is him speaking again.
Laying, because we got stopped at some point. Rockets started coming in. Had to be right next to someone who had, I believe, was killed because I checked his pulse. I had already, my weapon had stopped firing. Couldn't use it. Wasn't sure if I should try to drag him back, and there was a big guy. I said, no, I need to move about 50 feet. And bullets started coming, being walked toward the two of us. And the last one stopped right at the fellow, I don't know who it was, right in the chest. It was fairly big. It must have been a 50 caliber.
I just started seeing people coming back, not in groups, but straggling back, and some were wounded. Some were very severely wounded.
I just started crawling. They said I made it back to the base probably 6-8 hours later.
I was able to get out of there after some time. How long? I have no clue. But it was still daylight. But I could tell that the sun was, what there was of it, had already was going down. So I figured it had to have been late afternoon, early evening. And I knew where our lines were at. And I was able to evade some enemy soldiers. And I was able to get back. And then all of a sudden, here's these South Vietnamese Arvin Rangers. And they were waving at me, Dung Lai, Dung Lai, Dung Lai, to stop. And then I could see some American advisors to tell me to stop, halt, don't move, whatever. But I kept coming. Come to find out afterwards, I went through the entire minefield in front of Quezon and never touched a round off. Now I know why they kept telling me to stop, not to move.
A couple hours later, we were shelling that position. Airplanes were coming over, dropping bombs. And all of a sudden, out on the outskirts of the wire, a lone Marine came, and then I went out to get him. Walked through that minefield, not, you know, around the side, but through the minefield, and I was scared. Walked through the minefield, walked through the concertina, grabbed him. He was in absolute shock. grabbed by the arm, and we walked back through the minefield back into the perimeter.
The ambush only lasted a few minutes. It took me 35 years before I could get into my mind that we went out there at, you know, 9 or 9:30, whatever it was, 10 in the morning, and I didn't make it back into the base until the sun was going down, and used darkness as a cover to work my way back.
I've never been real religious or anything whatsoever, but I have to think that the man upstairs had something in his agenda. He says, I want to talk to you, young man.
You know, most of the guys went down the first minute. I mean, it was not a good thing. The actual battle itself, I mean, at that point, went on for hours. You know, I mean, the only reason I survived is I just happened to be standing in a bomb crater where there was like 2.5 feet deep where it blew the ground out. And I just happened to be walking through that at the time the ambush opened up. And when the first round went off, I dropped, and just my luck was I just dropped in that hole. So I was below ground level when all the, you know, all the bullets and everything were going over. And I just laid low there until the initial blast started, quieting down. And then you could tell they were just firing randomly. And if anybody moved, it just drew fire. And so I just laid near and threw grenades, just threw them as far as, into the trench line or towards it. Shot out a clip of ammo out of my rifle, which basically I figured out pretty quickly that was not a smart thing to do, because as soon as I fired around it, there was hundreds of guys were shooting back. So it was like, okay, don't draw attention to yourself. I ended up leaving my rifle and just trying to work my way through. I had a pistol, and I was using that for personal protection, because a rifle was useless at that point, and it was just something to carry. I would dive from one bomb hole to another, work behind anything I could find that was any kind of cover, and I would lay, I'd lay there for 15, 20, 30 minutes until as soon as you'd hit somewhere, the ammo, the bullets would, just drew fire. Grenades and stuff. Well, I was just far enough away that he couldn't throw a grenade and hit me, really. So, in between the firing, if it started to settle down a little bit, I would try to, peek above and try to see where I could get to. It took several hours of just, working my way across and trying to move out of the kill zone. And basically towards sundown, in the shadows, I could move better. And I worked my way out and back to the base, and when I came in, it was just like, where is everybody? And I just remember the guy saying, you're pretty much it. There isn't a whole lot. And when I got back to my squad area, Arthur Smith was in the bunker, and I came in, and he said that he was it. Can you take a break a minute? Okay. Some of this stuff is hard to talk about.
45 years later, hard to talk about, which is why this, in my opinion, ought to be mandatory and viewing for young Marines. In that, hey, when this stuff darkens your doorstep, it's going to impact you, and it's not going to go away.
Anyway, I got back to my area, and Wayne Moore, he was there, and there was, basically, I think there was, we were about the only two that came back out of it.
Doc Sakala got back, Steve Weiss got back, Cal Bright got back. A number returned.
I know there's been conflicting reports as far as how many of us went out. I was led to believe there was like anywhere from 60 to 70 of us that went out. And there was only just a small handful of us that come back.
That's kind of the notorious event at Quezon, was the Gulf Patrol. Because all those guys got killed, and they got left, the bodies got left out there, which Marines do not leave bodies.
I missed the Ghost Patrol. So I had a brother that was in Vietnam at the same time I was. So I went down to Da Nang to see my brother. When I finally do get back, my platoon is wiped out. I don't know anybody. I feel like I abandoned them. I've been thinking about this interview and stuff, and I'm going to get it out. I've been trying to prove myself ever since that deal with the Ghost Patrol and stuff, that I just feel guilty. And
the tragedy is, for us, is that they were ours. That's a tragedy. And it always has been, and it always will. But to many people, it's reading about it in a book. It's reading about it in a cold after-action report. It's reading criticisms and reading this and that. But that was our family, too. That we lost.
Our casualties at the end of the action were...
And again, this is Captain Pipes. This is
that quick.
Went down the first minute. I mean, it was.
Wow, that jumped on me. So bear with me as I get my spot back. Ken Pipes. Unbelievable. So this is the company commander talking right here.
Presumed either killed in action or prisoners of war. Some 22 Marines were returned wounded in action. And the platoon leader, Second Lieutenant Jacques, was hit and was killed in action and died from bleeding on the way back into the perimeter.
I think it broke all of our hearts.
I think this incident affected all of us. The company will be ready and anxiously awaiting the opportunity to move out and recover our fallen comrades. There's really not much more that I can say as company commander, except that we all feel this loss quite heavily. And indeed, are awaiting the opportunity to make up for and repay this terrible loss that we've suffered.
So that was Ghost Patrol. That audio is from ...1968, probably around February 26th, or it was certainly after the 25th, when he recorded it. Powerful, powerful, powerful stuff in terms of, Quezon wasn't simply about... wasn't about the shelling they had to endure on a daily basis. For those different companies that fought there, every one of them had episodes like this. And for Bravo Company, their Ghost Patrol was something that weighed on them, still weighs on them. The audio of the Marine that wasn't there, and he said, I've been thinking about this interview. I've been trying to prove myself ever since. Because I wasn't there, and I feel guilty about it. And how do you deal with that? But that's why it's such a great documentary relative to mental health. This is the lay of the land. These are the things that will you'll deal with in your life. And oh, by the way, this is why you need to train hard. This is why you need to be good. This is why you need to be disciplined, because the echoes of what you do will echo through the rest of your life. Tough stuff. All right, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and then I'm going to play you the second cut. And the second cut happens over a month later, and they go out on the attack to get their payback. And the vividness of the interviews and the comments it will blow your mind. More about Almond Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do. And I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, we'll continue here. The second cut that you're going to hear is the payback. And, you know, what's incredible about the work that Ken and Betty Rogers have done is that I think it has a little bit of the flavor that All Marine Radio has. With these guys, Ken Rogers, he's a battle buddy. he's a trusted agent, right? So they know him. They're comfortable with him. And so they sit down and they're comfortable being themselves and talking about them throughout the documentary. And it's awesome stuff. But so in a week that we the 50th anniversary of Quezon, and again there's a lot of other companies other than Bravo Company 126 all have similar stories, right? Trying not to get overrun, dealing with the shelling that they absorbed on a daily basis, and then their own I guess, feelings when they got a chance to go whooping on, to go take their revenge as warriors. And so, again, it's audio that's replete with intensity, stuff that really, really, you think about the intensity of the fights that the Marine Corps and the Army had with the NVA. Absolutely, positively amazing. So again, this next segment is called The Payback by these guys. And it involves a month later, on March 30th, them going out and them going and getting the NVA. And so, Bravo Company 126, here you go.
March 30th was what they call payback. And we went out to get the bodies, the 33 dead guys.
That's Ken Rogers, by the way.
The Ghost Patrol.
So again, if you didn't hear that, they're going back out to the same area that the Ghost Patrol went out, and they're going to get the bodies, something that never sat well with any of them. They're going to go because Marines don't leave, right? One of the legacies of World War II, one of the legacies of the Chosin Reservoir in Korea is we don't leave Marines behind. And so they lived with that for a month.
There was a building anger and a building desire.
Ken Pipes, the company commander.
To get outside the wire and to kill as many of them son of a bitches as we could kill.
March 30th, we went back out and it was payback time.
This was our chance to retrieve our fallen brothers and to kick a little ass. You know, let Charlie know what the United States Marine Corps was all about.
March 30th was one of those days where it was just, well, it wasn't one of those days. It was the most important day in my life. We got up very early in the morning, probably 4 o'clock in the morning.
And that morning, it was when the light started to come, it was foggy. And I thought, whoa, this is good. I really think God is with us. Because that covered us from being seen and our advancing on the enemy position.
We're organized as a group just to pick up the dead left out there the previous month. And we're just going to gather the bodies in body bags and bring them back. Supposedly they'd already had plenty of artillery and aircraft bomb that area so that it would be safe.
We went outside the wire, and we set up, and then right before daylight, we sent a squad out to kind of eyeball the tee and then report back. And before we would move further, Captain Pipes gave me an order to fix bayonets. And at that time, I told people later, it seemed like all of a sudden reality sunk into me. I mean, I don't know what I thought I was doing out there. I mean, this wasn't a Sunday picnic, but it didn't really hit me that this was going to be a major encounter, a major battle. And I, you know, my heart just sunk in my throat. I mean, it really did. And I said to the captain when he gave me the order, and I said, "Do what?" And he said, "Be advised to fix the bayonets." One of the platoon radio operators came back to me and said, "Do what?" Same thing I said to him. I said, "Be advised to fix bayonets."
That was something that just took me totally back, and I'm like, fix bayonets? You know, I mean, that just brought instant pictures of hand-to-hand combat, you know. So I can just remember telling the guys in the squad, okay, everybody fix bayonets, and everybody else doing the same thing. I'm like, what? But it's funny now, but it wasn't then.
All of us knew one day we'd go back out there.
He was a second lieutenant at the time, a guy named Peter Weiss. He was the one that led the QRF out there the day of that the Ghost Patrol got hammered. And so this is him again.
Clean up what we had to do.
Lieutenant Weiss called me up and he says, "Mac, you know, fix bayonets." I said, "Oh, man, fix bayonets." At this time, I'm saying, this is the real deal, man. So I told the rest of the guys, fix bayonets, and I could see on their faces what it must have looked on me, because this is not good.
The order came back, fix bayonets, and that's when everybody knew this deal was on. It was now.
And then I started looking around, and I was seeing these Marines taking bayonets out of their backpacks, out of their past leg, wherever they on their cartridge belt, wherever they had them, putting them on the end of their rifle. And then again, I thought to myself, this is the real McCoy. It finally hit me that I may not come back from this day.
Our platoon, 2nd platoon, went out of the wire first, ahead of the company, and we set up a point where the rest of the company could come and pass through us. And then the 1st and the 3rd platoon came out and swept through our position.
And once we started going, there was no walking. All of a sudden, it was an all-out assault, and we started running. Well, not carrying a radio with an extra 25 pounds on your back, I was really, I will admit, I was huffing and puffing. But I had to stay up with the skipper because I was his line of communication.
I can't believe we made it out through the line, out through the canyons and valleys, and came up on that ridge where the bodies were at. And it was very, very, very foggy, heavy fog, still not quite light. We were supposed to have helicopter and aircraft cover, and it was too heavy and fog to give us any cover.
We started the advance. We had 50 caliber machine guns who were firing over our heads. We had to go through a little valley. It wasn't very deep, but deep enough that we could have cover from the 50 calibers. And then as we approached the trench lines, they ceased. And at that point, what I remember was the fog lifted, and we could see pretty clearly. And we surprised them.
We broke out of the jungle into a flat, barren, chewed-up area of nothing but bomb holes and dirt divots, and we saw a trench, end of a trench, and a VC come out of the trench and squatted just outside the trench line and took a shit. And once he stood up to enter the trench again, someone said, "Let me get him. Let me shoot him." This guy with an M16 shot him, plow, and he was down. That was it.
It seemed like we had just started out, and then a round or two, a small arms fire went off. And then it just seemed like Charlie all of a sudden realized we were out there. And then all hell broke loose.
It was almost like popcorn being made, where you hear the pop, 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 pop.
I just wasn't raised that way, and I didn't want to really participate, and I was really amazed that there were so many people that were greedily trying to kill someone else. But, I mean, I guess that's a good reason, because they were actually trying to kill us, too, but I hadn't come to that realization yet. I just saw us killing them. I hadn't seen them kill us yet.
On the way to secure the trench, an artillery or a mortar round landed between the platoon sergeant and myself, blew us both off our feet under our asses. I got hit in the head with shrapnel. He got hit in the leg. We were alive, so we got up and went on, got in the trench.
We had this one guy coming charging at us. He couldn't have been, he was probably 100 feet, maybe a tiny bit farther away. But he was coming right at us for what reason, I don't know. He didn't even have a weapon. And one of the guys said, let me get him. And I'm just there. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I did not wish to take anyone's life. And so I was kind of hoping I could get through this experience without ever using my weapon. I was good with that. Anyway, so this guy took a .45, and he aimed, and he shot. And he was right beside me. And that guy at full bore running at us, folded like a cheap pocket knife, went back maybe a foot in the air, and fell to the ground.
First, I jumped into a trench. It was an NVA soldier. He didn't know what the hell was going on, as much as we didn't, you know. And I shot him, and I remember his eyes, and I remember him going down.
Well, this other guy, just beyond that one who came rushing at us, knows suddenly we're there. So he is running full bore away from us, and there's a guy with a law, one of those light armored, like a bazooka. He says, let me get him. I mean, this is so strange because we're all young idiots, and I hadn't ever killed anyone, and I had never fired my weapon except at a range, so I really didn't wish to play this game. But everyone was really, and they were excited about doing this. So anyway, but the whole weird part was, it's a running human being away from us, and this guy takes this law, it goes off, and you can watch it go through the air. It hit him dead center in the back, and it just blew up, and it was like you could see right through him. Pure light, and he was down.
Minutes were hours. Hours were seconds. I don't even remember how I. Everything slowed down and speeded up, and it was just crazy.
I noticed a person beyond, and they weren't 50 feet, 70, not even 75 feet, 50 feet away, and they had dropped down. And so I plinked a couple of rounds, and I got down. And we did that two or three times. And then I realized this was Pop Goes the Weasel. And that, so I quickly got up there out of rhythm. And when he came up, I just squeezed and shot. And it was the oddest thing. My instructor from the range in Camp Pendleton was there explaining to me about breathing and squeezing. My first shot, right in the head, right in the forehead. I had just done something I really didn't wish to do. And I'm laying there bewildered. And 20 feet away is another Pop Goes the Weasel. But he's shooting at my guys over here. And he's only 20 feet away. And he keeps popping up and shooting. I didn't want to think too much about it. Because for one thing, he's shooting live ammo at my people. So I just took aim and waited. And as he did it, I played the game again. Where I just squeezed and shot and hit him dead. Right through the temple, and he was gone.
They were still in bunkers and trench lines, and it became hand-to-hand. It became very slow progress because they were a well-trained unit. They were North Vietnamese regular army.
I mean, it was flamethrowers. There was rockets. Eddie Pendergrass, he'd run around a 60 mortar just sticking it in the ground, dropping the tubes, and just doing it by ear, you know, Kentucky windage. And they're shooting machine guns at this kid, and he's just dropping them all over the place.
I think his first name was Wayne Moore. His father had been a Marine. He was a tough, tough kid. And he's with me, and we're moving forward. And he said, this is the best. When I get out of the Marine Corps, this is what I want to do. And I thought, you're crazy.
And there was, you know, firing going on back and forth and the whole thing, and Wayne Moore, he jumped up and just, it was like he had had enough, and he jumped up and charged that machine gun bunker. And he was shot several times and didn't make it. And when he went down, Arthur Smith jumped up and he charged that bunker. And he was shot a couple of times, but he made it into the trench line. And the last thing I saw was Arthur in the trench line with a shot, shooting his rifle, heading, you know, going into the machine gun bunker, pulled out his bayonet, and was the last thing I saw him was fighting with a bayonet in the bunker.
To see the men of Bravo Company moving out with fixed bayonets and going through those trenches almost fearlessly was one of the most amazing things that I've ever been a part of in my whole life.
but all of a sudden it was just a big a roar, and everybody jumped up, and we all started charging the line. And I just remember us jumping up and running towards that line firing, and I looking over my shoulder and seeing it was like a ribbon effect. Everybody down that line was just getting up and taking off towards that trench.
I believe all of the young Marines that we had in the company had been waiting several weeks for this opportunity. And I think for all of us that were involved there, it's something, particularly in a leadership capacity, something that none of us will ever forget. Once the kids started, there was nothing, it seemed, that could stop them.
First bomb crew.
What you're listening to, if you joined us in the middle of this, is some audio from the documentary that Ken and Betty Rogers made. The documentary is entitled Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. It's a story of Bravo Company 126. And as you can tell, the accounts are so vivid. It's amazing. And these accounts are 45 years after when he did this, more than 45 years after these events took place. And as I said, there's incredible lessons relative to mental health here about learning how to live with it, getting the help that you need. And it's also so incredible to listen to the accounts. One guy's name is, I want to say Frank Riley or something like that. He was talking about the law being shot and hitting a guy and hearing his drill instructor, his range coach at the range, telling him to breathe and squeeze. It's almost, and he takes you through the neurotic conversation that he's having with himself. It's almost like George Costanza goes to combat. He's a Catholic. He doesn't even want to use his weapon. The last time he fired it was on the range. He didn't really want to kill anybody. And he's looking around, and people are enjoying this. And so, and you'll hear more from him. But this is so well done. It's amazing. But these are the Marines from Bravo Company. One of the companies at Quezon. And as I said earlier, the audio is absolutely positively riveting.
I do remember we got in. The rounds hit right outside the bomb crater, and Skipper said, we got to get the hell out of here. They got us spotted. And then we got into an NVA trench line. And at this time, the fighting was intense.
I mean, up close, personal bayonets. Satchel charging their bunkers, flamethrowers.
Somehow I ended up next to a man with a flamethrower. And, again, talking like we're talking here. And I said to him, I said, how long does one of those tanks last of fire? And he was telling me, whatever he told me, it wasn't very any time at all. Just seconds, you know, if you held the thing on full and let the whole tank empty. I said to him, I said, well, that doesn't seem very long. He said, if you're on the other end of it, it's an eternity.
Oh, man. You know, this was Iwo Jima kind of stuff.
We went on the move, and we moved forward fairly smartly. There's a lot of action going on. Probably went through at least a half dozen bunkers. You know, personally, one guy in front, shooting into the bunkers while a guy went around and dropped grenades into each of these bunkers.
When I got in those trenches, 1st and 3rd Battalion had killed so many of them people that they were just bodies everywhere. I don't think my foot ever touched the ground. And I was in that trench, I know, for over an hour.
I kind of moved and rolled away and went down into this giant crater that was left by some B-52 bomb that was about 10 feet deep and probably 20 feet across and a little puddle of water at the bottom. It scared the shit out of me because when I first rolled into there, I could see some green uniforms and I thought, oh shit. And then I realized they were American uniforms, but they were three dead Americans laying there sprawled across the sides of the dish. And all of a sudden something hit my eye and I looked. And there's this guy comes charging in, one of our guys, gets down, his head's just about ground level, whips back, his helmet flies, and he falls right at my feet, and his brain goes across the dirt. And I'm sitting there on the side of this hill, looking at this guy, and he's like a goldfish. His eyes are bulging like a chihuahua, and he's breathing, gulping, and he's got his brains spread out beyond his skull.
Now, if you could see the video, this guy, right, whose account is one of the most vivid accounts I've ever seen of anything like this, he's staring at the ground. He's not staring at the camera when he's doing this. And you can see that he's literally reliving the events. The other thing that Ken does, he told a story about the audio engineer that wanted to work on this project with them. You can hear how they use audio to bring it home, right? And it's not background audio. The gunshots, when he talked about shooting, tell me that didn't rattle your eardrums a little bit, all right? And if you have a subwoofer, it made that thing move a little bit too. But just extremely, extremely intense.
Because there's no top. And all of a sudden, somebody else comes down. And it's a guy who rolls in who's been shot. And so he's sitting over there. And then another guy comes in. And that's a corpsman. And the corpsman, I tell the corpsman, I go, you got to help this guy. And he comes quickly over. And he starts to push the brain back into the skull. And he goes, I can't do anything for this guy. And he quickly goes over to the guy who had an arm shot. So I'm sitting there in this hole watching the corpsman work on somebody, guy who's gulping at me, and three dead on the edge. And I'm going, this ain't the hole I need to be in.
This ain't the hole I need to be in. Unbelievable. Awesome stuff, though, right?
So I quickly crawled out, and then incoming was coming like crazy orders. And so I saw a small hole, someplace to get below ground, save my ass. So I hauled butt, and I jumped with my rifle in my hand. And as I was getting through the air, I suddenly realized, and you can't stop because you're in the air heading for this hole, that it's occupied. It's got dead people in it. I did a still push up in the air and did not go down on it, but I am face to face with a guy who's been dead for quite a while, and he has very little skin on his face, on the skull. It's just parchment skin peeled like a creek bottom that's been dried up, and he's got maggots coming out of eye sockets but no eyes, and coming out of his nose. And then below him is another guy in the same shape. These are two decayed, bad news bodies.
I am Lance Corporal Michael H. McCauley, 2357567, United States Marine Corps. I'm a squad leader in the 1st Platoon, Bravo Company, 3rd Squad, 26 Marines, the 3rd Marine Division. On March 30th, Bravo Company went on a patrol outside Quezon Combat Base. We started receiving small arms from the rear. Automatic weapon opened up. My squad leader took a fire team and went back, found enemy position, destroyed it before he was killed by a mortar round. Then I took over the squad. And we continued up the trench line. Then they started dropping in mortars all around us.
I remember the 10 Normans behind me. He had seen our senior corpsman get hit with my mortar, and he had started to stand up and say, Doc's been hit. And when he did, I was crouched in the trench line. I had one hand on my rifle and the other hand on my receiver, and I turned around to hear what he had said as he was standing up. And by that time, several rounds of enemy mortars fell right on top of us and took Lieutenant Norman right out. His radio operator basically kind of busted out, and blood running through his fingers. I was hit. Captain Feist was hit, and his radio operator, battalion radio operator, was also hit. We was all knocked out just in that matter of seconds. The rounds came in and knocked every one of us out. and like I said, unfortunately killed Lieutenant Norman.
I don't know if it was Captain Pipes or who it was, but somebody said, pick that Marine up and take him back. And I bent down and picked him up, and it was Hank Norman.
I don't know his name. This is one of the other platoon commanders who ultimately, Hank Norman, is a fellow platoon commander as well.
It was just a real ass kicker. You know, it just represented all the heartache Bravo come right there.
And he took the brunt of the round that I caught shrapnel in my side. And then my hand also had busted out in blood. I thought I'd lost a few fingers, but then I found out later it was a concussion. It had forced the blood from out of the pores of my hand.
And Kenny Pikes was standing there. And I thought to myself, my God, he was blood from one end to the other. I mean, he was soaked in it. And he had two radios, and he was talking to the air on one radio, and he was talking to the artillery on the other radio. And here, all his best friends are laying right here dead at his feet. And this guy's still taking care of business.
I finally met up with my machine gun guy. I was supposed to be the A-gunner to him, and he finally came in the hole, and then this other tall corporal came in, and he decides that the reason everyone around us is dying is because there's a machine gun nest over there, and it's like 150 feet away, and it's nothing but more than a big sandbag with a tiny slit in it, and they're ripping on us. And so he says, come on, it's our job, we gotta knock it out. Well, I've seen enough war movies to realize the first wave on a machine gun nest doesn't make it. So anyway, he goes, come on, let's go. And he's actually trying to drag me and the machine gunner out of that hole and head for that spot. Fine, okay, that's cool. Well, okay, we will do it because that's kind of what we're supposed to be doing. But I wanted to just see what we were doing. I mean, I didn't want to go out of that hole blind. So I took a peek, and I could see the sandbag, and I could see where it was at. And I said, okay. So anyway, I did my clip, put a new clip in, and I looked at the dirt in front of me on that bowl, and I thought, that's cool. That's the last thing I'm going to see, because I'm going to fall right face down in that shit when I leave this hole. And so we charged out of there, all three of us.
Is he awesome or what? It's awesome because everybody's got this voice inside of him, and it's almost like he has stored his in high definition for 45 plus years and is now giving it to everybody else, you know, live. But it's his inner monologue, right? It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen on video. So vivid that he recalls it like this.
And I was the middle, and the machine gunner was here, and the knucklehead here, third of the way there. He spun, got hit, and left us. But I put every round, all 20 rounds, dead center through that little teeny-weeny slit, and the machine gunner, he was chewing up those sandbags, and we made it. We made it. We made it to there and jumped over the sandbags, and there's this big sandbag pit, two dead gooks, and of course, the guy with the machine gun, he's kind of, his adrenaline's flowing. So he just blasts them anyway.
The platoon commander, Lieutenant Dillon, says to me, he says, well, mark the spot so they know where you're at, basically. And I said, I don't know what color. I forgot. I was so like this, I didn't know. And so he said, it's a canary. So we reached and got a yellow smoke grenade and threw it out there, and it billowed up. And right then, this barrage of artillery right out in front of us, American stuff, just flattened everything out there. And then we just started moving back and picking up the dead Marines.
And then I took Lieutenant Norman, and I carried him back to the APC. But I remember he weighed so much. He was so heavy, my legs ached so bad. And I just kept telling myself, don't you dare drop him. Whatever you do, don't drop him. And I got back to the APC, and it was just body stacked in the back damn thing. And I link him down. It's just gently as I could.
I got hit in the leg with shrapnel. A bomb, mortar went off right next to my leg, and it violently rolled me over. Lost my helmet, lost my rifle. I laid there in shock because I could feel my leg was burning, but I couldn't feel anything below the burn. I looked down, and my boot and leg was, everything was still there, and I'm thinking, it's got to be separated. So I wiggled my toe, and my toes wiggled back in my boot, and I went, oh, shit. So I felt like my boot was filling up and overflowing with blood, but I still had a leg. I worked my way down and into a trench and headed toward where we had come in, and lo and behold, that the steps that lead the trench where we first saw that guy taking his morning dump, there's the guy that led the charge against the machine gun nest, and he is half passing out. He's clutching me. He's going, help me, help me. And there's a Marine crawling next to us, heading toward the back, toward the rear. I mean, just literally, he's hurt, he's wounded. And then suddenly I see this guy coming. Whips his head, helmet flips, and he's got no chin. He does this, and all he's got is upper teeth and a big giant tear in his neck. He throws his rifle down, he spins, and starts running back, but no. In just a matter of two steps, he stopped, he grabbed the guy on the ground, and they both hobbled away toward the rear, and I'm thinking, he could go with a guy with no chin and help somebody. With my little dumb leg, I could probably do it. So, okay.
His story is incredible that he tells. Can you imagine having your lower jaw shot off and having the presence of mind to pick somebody else up and medevac them, carry them to safety? You know, that whole thing, where do we get such men? You know, it's true. When you see him in combat, it literally takes your breath away.
Got him in a fireman's carry, and we walk up. There's like a couple of steps out of that trench, and then suddenly automatic machine gun fire opens up on us. And he takes a round. I could feel him. I mean, he moves on my body. And I went, holy shit. So like, as fast as I was flying, I don't think I even touched ground much, but I hauled ass with him on my back. I saw a hole, and I just chucked him and fell in on top of him. And unfortunately, on that run, his arm, which had already been wounded, he got hit again, and the arm was gone. When I had picked him up, it just had some skin on it, holding it to the rest of his body, but that bullet removed it, so... Anyway, we got him back, and I got back. It was one of those days. And those days.
Part of my job was to set up a battalion aid station that went out with us. We took a doctor out with us. Immediately, people were being wounded, and so I was starting to help bring wounded back, bring some dead back. I had a 60 mortar group that was with me. Corporal Corco was in charge of that, and he says, I've shot all my rounds. What do you want me to do?
I'm a gun hog. I'm supposed to be in charge of the mortar section, but I like doing that. But then we started taking casualties, so I turned the gun over to one of our other guys and started hauling guys back in.
So I started using them to help me to bring the dead and wounded back.
So the first guy went out and drug this guy back in, and then went out and to get another guy that was screaming. He'd been wounded. And this other guy that I brought in, he's laying on his back, and he's screaming, my leg, my leg. And when I come up, there's a hole blown in his flak jacket and a bunch of his guts exposed. Got him drug on back, going out after another guy. Running ahead, again, you didn't have to look for wounded people. We had a bunch. On lip of a bomb crater, there's Ben Long and Steve Weiss. As I'm running by, Ben hollers at me, "Get down."
Corporal Weiss and I, we ran into a bomb crater. And we yelled at Corporal Corcoran, "Get down, get down." But he didn't do it.
Famous last words. I turned to him this way and I said, "Come out and enjoy the war." That's why old politicians send young kids off to war. Young kids are stupid. They're invincible. They're caught up with adrenaline.
And then about 6 mortars went off on the rim.
The closest one was about 2 feet away. The furthest one was about 8 feet away. There was one in between. Ben's got this ruddy complexion. And, I mean, it just drained because he'd just seen one of his good men get blown to bits in front of him.
He was riddled. I mean, because he had a flak vest and diaper on, and it didn't kill him. And I remember one went through his helmet, but blood was just pouring down. And
my helmet's been blown off. I've got shrapnel here under the eye. You know, both arms are totally useless. This leg's got a big hole in it. I'm telling you, I could not have taken another step.
There was a guy that was, you know, been hit by a mortar, and he was pretty badly wounded. And the lieutenant called me over and, you know, needed help, and we picked him up. And there was still a lot of fire going on, and we pulled him back and, you know, pulled him back to the rear. And I just remember thinking, this guy is, you know, it was almost a waste. I mean, why are we trying to drag this guy back? You know, he was wounded pretty badly. And so I just assumed he died.
I didn't know what happened to him until years later. I found out he did live and he survived. He still has shrapnel in him today.
This guy, basically a dead man to me, five years ago, I think, I get a phone call. I was coming back from a job, and I get a phone call on my cell phone, and he goes, "Do you believe in guys coming back from the dead?" And I'm like, I says, "What?" And he's like, told me who he was, and he goes, "I just remember this blonde-haired angel dragging me out, you know." And that was a pretty amazing phone call, you know, that to find out this guy had actually survived and was doing well, you know. His name was Ken Korkow, and he ended up getting a Navy Cross that day.
What a fine group of Marines that we were fortunate enough to be part of. And I thought of that and think of it almost every day. Those three things. The beginning, the 25th, and the 30th.
That is Ken Pipes, company commander. He just did an interview with the Washington Post, so he's going to get a phone call from me today. I think that, if you want a personal opinion, you know, Captain Pipes has to live with the fact that he ordered, you know, that patrol to go get, one, he ordered them out, two, he ordered them to go get those prisoners. And I'm sure years later he wonders, you know, was it just a ruse to get my guys in, going in that direction and lure them into an ambush? And as a commanding officer, nobody can lift that burden from you. And so the times I've spoken with him, he's reluctant to do interviews. But you know what? There's incredible merit in the way he held his company together. But nobody can lift the burden of command from you. And, and living with the death of your Marines and wondering if you did the right thing, that's tough. So again, there's so many lessons that we can all learn from, Ken and Betty Rogers' work. And like I said, that's just a snippet of it. It's so well done. And as I said, to me, it's post-combat mental health 101. And we'll talk about that with Ken on Monday, but, pretty intense. The most intense interviews and descriptions I think I've ever seen. And the most well done. I you know, you, and the audio certainly the way they engineered the audio certainly heightens the experience for anybody that listens. But again, if you're interested in watching the whole thing, you can just do a search on Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. It's also, the website's called Bravo the Project. And again, I just want to salute Ken and Betty Rogers for the incredible work that they did relative to putting this together. You know, and I met Ken, I don't know, a year or two ago, and had him on, and he and I have become friends. And it's just an incredible piece of work that salutes the valor of his fellow Marines, the Navy corpsmen that supported them, in a fight that occurred 50 years ago that we're talking about. But again, to me, as somebody who's a who's the father of two Marine officers, I absolutely believe that there's value in all Marine leaders seeing this. All Marine leaders seeing this. Because, again, this was not, the war in Vietnam in the Central Highlands is not, it's not the same war that we fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is with a foe that has a regular army that wants to come fight you, that will close with you, that will kill you, and is very capable. That's not the fight we fight now. We're ambushed, we're IED'd. Direct fire engagements, Marines salivate for those. Soldiers salivate for those. You mean they're going to square up and fight? Let's do this. Let's go get them. So, but again, I just want to applaud Ken and Betty Rogers for the incredible work that they've done. That is awesome as a military guy to listen to. And I've given it to both my sons who've watched it and have shared it with their friends. So anyway, I was motivated. I didn't sleep well last night. And I think the reason I didn't sleep well was I was so excited about this audio and bringing it to you. And again, it's just a snippet of their documentary, which is, as I said, I would tell you is absolutely, positively fantastic. That'll do it. About a half hour over on a Wednesday. Yeah, that's how fired up I was. Busted the clock. Anyway, my thanks to Beth Harvey for coming on this morning. My thanks to Ken and Betty Rogers, one, for being great friends of the program, and two, for just the incredible work that they've done to honor the courage, the sacrifice of so many Marines over the course of a 77-day period from one company at a place called Khe Sanh that happened 50 years ago. So that'll do it. Don't touch that dial. The program repeats itself momentarily. And again, if you missed it, we'll do news and headlines. So we'll do that. And then we'll also... Beth Harvey joins us, and we talk about, is the Navy going to be able to convict the commanding officers of the McCain and the Fitzgerald of negligent homicide? And I said, the Navy doesn't need another public failure. So the decision to charge that the way they've charged it, pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. So we talk about that. We talk about the Article 32 that's going to happen, and that. And then if you tuned in right at the end of this segment, by all means, hang around and hear it again, because it's some of the most vivid audio I've ever heard from oral histories. Have a great day on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.